Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast of Who's Here in the Hamptons. I'm Dan Rettina, your host, broadcasting from my home in the Hamptons, where I have lived for over 55 years. I've written a dozen books about this glorious place, and I've seen it grow through the years from small tourist towns, quaint fishing villages, and a summer playground for high society to what it is today, a world-class resort for celebrities, artists, musicians, authors, and billionaires. In my podcast, I will bring you interviews with not only these people, but also prominent local people who have helped shape the Hamptons. Welcome to Dan's Talks. I'm Dan Rettina, the founder of Dan's Papers, and my guest today is David Reynolds, prominent author of historic novels, who is going to be part of the Friday at 5 program, which is an all-summer reading at the Bridgehampton Library and speaking about what's in the book, which is a very popular event in these parts. What are you going to be talking about, and when is the date of it? I think I have July 24, is that correct?
Yeah, Dan, it's good to be here. July 24th, yeah, that'll be the date. And I'll be talking about my new book, which is Two Ships, and it's about the arrival in 1619 of the slave ship that came to Jamestown, Virginia. And then the next year, the Mayflower, which came to Plymouth, Massachusetts, announcing freedom and democracy. And it's a history of the deep cultural divisions in America from the very beginning right up to the 20th century, with foreshadowings of today's ideological polarization and divide. So it's a deep history of polarization.
I presume the former is because of the need for workers in the South. Is that correct?
Well, what happened is that both the North and the South needed workers. In general, previously, they had been white workers who became indentured servants. That's servants who work for a few years and then are freed. But when these 20-odd Africans were brought to the South, progressively, the South became a slave society, okay? And the workers became black. In the North, yes, we had some enslaved people. The Hamptons had it, New England had it, but very few in comparison to the South. So that by 1770, the North becomes a society with a few slaves, and the South becomes a true slave society with a very, very high percentage of the population working on the big plantations in the South.
I think we all know it's because in the South they had no other ability to farm cotton, and I don't know what they were back and so forth, and except to have it done by hand. Because this was before the cotton gin and everything else. Didn't they call that our peculiar
institution, the South's peculiar institution?
Right.
Yeah. But the slave system, as my book shows, in the South was supported by an ideology of hierarchy and subordination, with some people on top, some people in the middle, and the enslaved people on the bottom. And I show in my book that this was a transplant of the cavalier mentality in England. There had been a huge war in England between the cavaliers, who supported the established church and the king and royalty and all of that. Then there was a rebellion against the cavaliers in England by the Puritans, who then came to New England, and they believed much more in the common person, the common man, and in democracy. And that's why slavery in the South was structured on this hierarchy of subordination, whereas in the North, you had a much more egalitarian, equal, common man tradition that eventually made the North anti-slavery. And that's why they went back to the two ships, to the Mayflower representing equality and liberty, and the slave ship representing the cavalier hierarchy of the South.
If you're studying this and writing about it, are you describing about what we know about life on board these ships, and did they come within a year or two of one another?
Yeah, the slave ship came to Jamestown, Virginia in 1619, and slowly slavery blossomed from that, or grew from that first 20 enslaved people to a vast 4 million enslaved people by the Civil War. But the following year, in 1620, came the Mayflower. So they had two very different purposes. One in the South to deliver kidnapped Africans, and one in the North to deliver rebels against authority in the Mayflower, which fed into the democracy of Plymouth Colony. And that's why the subtitle of my book, Two Ships, is Jamestown 1619, Plymouth 1620, and the Struggle for the Soul of America. It's a struggle that's been really ongoing, even up to this very day, two competing visions of what America should be.
Well, they're also far enough apart that you could make a case, actually, that they weren't aware of one another or could develop from the beginning as two different countries. Wouldn't that be the case in a way?
That's basically what happens, Dan, is that at the beginning, they're not really competing symbols. They're competing countries in a sense. Yeah, they're developing their own ideology, their own sense of who should be on top and who should be on the bottom. And it's really only later on that they come to symbolize a real cultural war. They even, by the time the Civil War, when they go to war, that's in 250 years later, in the 1860s, they literally reduce themselves to the Mayflower and the slave ship, but also to two different civilizations. So what happens is, yes, they blossom almost independently over time, but then they become two competing national ideologies that end up in a war that kills over 700,000 Americans.
So the idea of, I guess, in Jamestown, they were just like servants because they were interested at the beginning of that time to just survive. There was nothing about an economy or anything like that for either of them. They just came, and I think Jamestown ran into trouble.
Well, Jamestown, it had originally been settled in 1607, and by 1623 had been largely decimated. There was great starvation. There were war with the Native Americans that nearly wiped out Jamestown itself. It was a terrible situation. So they needed anything to survive, these planters at the beginning. And they were taking white servants, they were taking African servants. At the beginning, there was very little distinction between the white and the black servants. And some of the black servants became freed and emancipated and owned property and even owned slaves themselves. But gradually, there arose this kind of racial distinction between black and white servants. So the slavery in 1662 was instituted by law, saying that anyone who was born of an enslaved mother, an African enslaved mother, had to be a slave. So, and then that gathered over time, and there were very strict slave codes over time. So, yeah, at the beginning, it was a matter of survival. And in Virginia, it was the tobacco planters at first. And tobacco plantations greatly outnumbered cotton plantations, really until the 18th century, and then slowly cotton, with the advent of the cotton gin in the 1790s, really took over. And tobacco, it was still there, but it took second place. But both depended heavily on African slavery. Yeah.
How did the two ships compare? Of course, they never knew one another. Well, did they each come from different parts of England? And also, were the ships arranged so that the quarters are different?
No, the ships were actually almost exactly the same, because what happened is that an English ship departed from Jamestown going to the West Indies, not looking for slaves. They wanted to interfere with Spanish trade. And it interfered with a Spanish ship that happened to carry some cargo that were slaves. And they said, "Oh, this is interesting cargo." The ship was not looking for slaves, but it ran into a slave ship that was going to the West Indies. "This is interesting cargo. It happens to be human beings. Let's go back and sell them as servants or slaves, whatever." So they went back to Jamestown, sold them or traded them for food, and that was that. But it was a very similar kind of ship to the Mayflower. And the Mayflower wasn't predominantly Puritans. It was mainly just merchants going to America looking to make a little money. But the Puritans became the ruling party when they reached Plymouth Colony. But the quarters were pretty much the same. Now, the original slave ship that had been interfered with by the White Lion, which brought the slaves to Virginia, was a horrible, horrible ship. Had 350 Africans that was headed for the West Indies. They were crammed into impossibly small quarters, only 3 feet of space above them. They were chained together. It was full of the stench of vomit and of feces. They were barely fed. And of the 350, only about 180 actually made it to the West Indies. They were dying left and right. That was horrible. But when they came to Virginia, at least they became servants. Of course, eventually slavery turned out to be very horrible in the South. But initially, they were treated more or less the way the same as the white servants were in
How,
Virginia.
what were the lengths of these ships?
The lengths?
Yeah, lengths. How long was the ship?
Oh, the lengths were, well, the quarters were only about where the people actually lived, which was below deck, was only about 105 or 110 feet. Now, in the Mayflower, that was pretty bad too, because you had 102 passengers sleeping mainly on the floor, sometimes on straw mattresses, side by side. It was a very leaky ship. You had 30 crew members as well, so you had a total of 152 people. And if you visit the Mayflower in Plymouth and you go down there, you say, my goodness, how did all these people fit in this very, very cramped space? And also, they had two dogs, one huge mastiff and another poodle. And shockingly, only one guy died on the voyage, although people were so malnourished by the time they reached Plymouth that four died on the Mayflower before it landed. And then half of the Mayflower people died in the first year. They just starved to death and they were freezing. They arrived in December. They were just freezing to death. So half of them died. Only about 50 survived. But, they had enough to develop a little corn and they had the first Thanksgiving and all of that. So they slowly built up families in Plymouth.
Were they, by the Native Americans, hostily or friendly or curious?
Initially, well, they had what they called the first encounter where the Native Americans didn't know who these people were and they shot arrows at them. And the white people scared them off with muskets. But what was amazing that was the Native Americans at first struck a truce saying, okay, we'll protect you pilgrims, against the Native Americans, but we, the Narragansett and Wampanoag people, you can maybe protect us against our enemies, because there were a lot of inter-tribal warfare. And so they struck up a truce with the pilgrims. And indeed, on the first Thanksgiving, there were more Native Americans than there were pilgrims. They had struck up a truce that lasted really until Massasoit, who was a good, very good Native American, he died. And then his son Philip, at first he was called King Philip. His real name was Metacom. He unfortunately gave away too much land to the white people for too, he didn't know how to trade. So for a few beads and a few furs, he gave up vast territories. So he became stranded really in Bristol, Rhode Island, and finally desperately tried to strike out against the white people in King Philip's War, but he was massacred and quartered. And the white people by then were pretty much anti-Native American and they took over the land. But that happened, a good 50 years after the pilgrims, actually 60 years after the pilgrims landed. Initially, they had very good relations with the Native Americans.
Tell me a bit about people who might be listening to this podcast about Friday at 5. And I presume you've been to this program. It's been going on for almost 30 years, I believe. And
Friday at 5 is a very engaging situation where you sit outdoors. I've appeared there a couple of times and people kind of gather. There's room for 350 people and you get a chance to listen to a breakdown of a certain author's book and the way the author writes, and also the basic themes of the book and why it should interest readers, for example, in American history in this year of the 250th anniversary of American independence, and how the two ships feeds into both the American Revolution and the Civil War, and what it means for today, for example, in our ideological divide, and how we can overcome this divide, how we can live through it. We can look to people like our founding fathers who came together during the American Revolution. We can look to Abraham Lincoln, who rejected cultural division and believed in American democracy and in human equality. So we can talk about that. I've appeared there several times. It's a wonderful event, and the audience has a chance to get involved, to get some signed books, maybe, but also to ask questions about the author and get to know the author, his or her themes and interests and so forth. So it's a time for a kind of intimate exchange.
This is in Bridgehampton at the Bridgehampton Library, which for some reason is called the Hampton Library. And it's in the back, the library fronts on Main Street. And it's one of the most popular events we have during the summer. And the back has a vast lawn, a pretty big lawn. They set up chairs out there. It's just wonderful to sit out there and listen to people like yourself who are knowledgeable about what they've been writing about. And I think it's a feather in your cap to be invited to be having this experience.
Well, I love Fridays at 5. I make many appearances on podcasts and everything, but I prefer this beautiful, lovely outdoor setting and the kind of casual atmosphere, too. It's not stiff at all, and there's back and forth with the audience, too. So it becomes very entertaining.
And I recall you live in Sagaponack, which is
Right, I got you.
writing room there.
Yeah, I do have a writing room, and, you once did a feature on me, and I think I showed you my little room, which is kind of messy and full of books. But I guess that's the way writers' rooms are. I mean, heck, Kurt Vonnegut used to, well, he came out here, and Truman Capote came out here. A lot of writers, John Irving, James Jones, have come out to Sagaponack and to the Hamptons in general to kind of escape the confinement of the city and all of that. And being out in nature is just wonderful, and Sagaponack is very, very, very open and full of farm fields, and it's just wonderful in that sense. Very inspiring.
Do you come out for the summer or do you come out year round?
We try to come out as much year round as possible, certainly into the fall and through most of the spring, and certainly we're here on the summer. Sometimes we live on what used to be a farm field, potato field, and sometimes our backfield becomes a sort of tundra in the winter, covered with ice and snow. So it becomes a little forbidding, and we have a home in Nassau County as well, so we sometimes huddle there in the winter, but in certain winter months. But we love being out here on Sagaponack. It's so open. We love the sky. We love the ocean.
Thank you for being on the podcast, and I'll get to see you at Friday at 5.
It'll be great to see you, Dan, and a lot of your viewers too, and listeners, and bring all your friends.
Okay.
Okay.